This is Ed Morrow. Here is how a mother and father remember their son, Michael Farmer.
Michael was tall and very good-looking. He had blonde hair and blue eyes. Maybe I'm prejudiced as a mother, but I thought he had a saintly face.
He was always laughing and joking. A very courageous, spirited boy. He was athletic, even though he walked with a limp from an attack of polio when he was 10 years old. He was an excellent student, and we had great plans for his future. It's a hard thing to realize that there is no future any longer.
Michael Farmer died on the night of July 30, 1957. He was 15 years old. He was stabbed and beaten to death in a New York City park. Boys in a teenage street gang were arrested for this crime. 10 gang members under 15 years of age were convicted of juvenile delinquency and committed to state training schools. 7 other boys, 15 to 18, stood trial for first-degree murder, were defended by 27 court-appointed lawyers. Their trial lasted 93 days, ended last Tuesday. This was the verdict of an all-male blue-ribbon jury.
We found Louis Alvarez and Charles Horton guilty of murder in the second degree. We also found Liencio de Leon and Leroy Boich guilty of manslaughter in the second degree. We found Richard Hills and George Melendez not guilty because we believe these boys were forced to go along with the gang the night of the murder. We also found John McCarthy not guilty because we were convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that this boy was mentally sick and didn't know what was going on at any time.
It would seem that this case is now closed. All that remains is for a judge to pass sentence. Under the law, the gang alone is guilty of the murder of Michael Farmer. But there is more to be said. More is involved here than one act of violence committed on one summer night. The roots of this crime go back a long ways. In the next hour, you will hear the voices of boys and adults involved in the case. This is not a dramatization. The tragedy first became news on the night of July 30, 1957. At 6:30, on this steaming summer evening in New York City, the Egyptian Kings and Dragons gang began to assemble. They met outside a neighborhood hangout, a candy store at 152nd Street and Broadway in Manhattan's Upper West Side. They came from a 20-block area, from teeming tenements, rooming houses, and housing projects. One of their leaders remembers the number of boys present this night.
We had a lot of little kids, big kids. We had at least 75. Then a lot of them had to go home before 9 o'clock. We were supposed to leave at 9 o'clock, but then changes were planned to 10 o'clock, you know? So I told a lot of little kids I don't want to see them get in trouble, you know, nice guys, you know? So I told them they could go home. So they went home. That left us with around 21 kids.
People sitting on the stoops and garbage cans along the street watched them, grouped together, talking excitedly. They called each other by their nicknames, Magician, Big Man, Little King, Boppo. No one bothered to ask what they were talking about. This boy remembers.
They were talking about what they were going to do and everything, if they were going to fight and everything, but they'd never planned nothing. They just said, we're going to go to the fight and we're going to get some guys for revenge. They said, we ain't going to let the jesters beat up any of our guys no more.
The jesters are a street gang in an adjoining neighborhood, Washington Heights, where Michael Farmer lived. The two gangs were feuding. Boys on both sides had been beaten and stabbed. There is evidence that this night the gang planned to surprise and attack any jester they could find. They came prepared for a fight.
Some picked a stick and some had got some knives and chains out of their houses and everything. One had a bayonet. No, a machete.
Holding these weapons, they lingered on the corner of a brightly lit street in the heart of a great city. A police station was one block away. One gang leader went to a candy store, telephoned the president of a brother gang, requested guns and cars for the night's activity, was told, we can't join you. We have troubles of our own tonight. Shortly after 9 p.m., the gang walked to a nearby park, was followed there by some girlfriends. A gang member, 14 years old, continues the story.
I went down to the park. And we sat around for a while. Then we started drinking. We drank whiskey and wine. And we was drunk. We started talking about girls. We started saying to the girls that if they get us, to bring us some roses and all that. That if we get caught, to write to us and all this.
In 1 hour, Michael Farmer would be dead. The gang prepared to move out. Some had doubts.
I didn't want to go at first. So they said, come on. So then all the big guys forced me to go. I was scared. I was worried. I realized, like, what I was doing, I'd probably get in trouble.
They left the park and headed for trouble at about 10 p.m. They walked uptown toward the neighborhood of the rival gang, the Jesters. They walked in twos and threes to avoid attention. Along the way, they met by chance this boy.
I was walking uptown with a couple of friends, and we was coming down that way. And we ran into a magician, and they asked us if we wanted to go to a fight. And we said, yeah. And, you know, when they asked me if I wanted to go to a fight, I couldn't say no. I mean, I could say no, but you know, for old time's sake, so I said yes.
He was a former member of the gang, just went along this night for old time's sake. Next stop, Highbridge Park, within the territory of the Jesters. Michael Farmer lived one block from the park. In the summer, the Egyptian kings and dragons fought the Jesters at the park swimming pool. This pool is closed at 10 p.m., but not drained. Boys in the neighborhood frequently slip through a breach in the gate and swim here late at night. The Egyptian kings and dragons regrouped near the pool. Two gang members continue the story.
We were waiting over there in the grass. Then two guys went down to see if there was a lot of the fellas down there. The chest is, I was kind of nervous, you know, I felt like cold inside.
And they sent three guys around the block. We walked around the block to see how strong the club was. We was going to fight. To see if they had lots of guys and whatnot. What we saw, they had lots of big guys. I say about 19, 20, 18, like that. And we figured it out, so we kept on walking around the block.
While their scouts prowled the neighborhood, Michael Farmer and his friend, 16-year-old Roger McShane, were in Mike Farmer's apartment listening to rock and roll records. This is Mrs. Farmer.
They stayed in his room playing these new records that they had bought. And Michael came out to the kitchen. Just as I asked my husband what time it was to set the clock, it was then 9:55. He asked for a glass of milk. And as he walked from the kitchen, he said, I'm going to walk Roger home. And that was the last time I saw him.
Both boys had been warned by their parents to stay out of Highbridge Park at night. But as they walked along the street on this steaming July evening, they decided to sneak a swim in the park pool. At this pool, the Egyptian kings and dragons were waiting for their scouts to return. Here is what happened next, first in the words of Roger McShane, then in the words of the gang members.
It was 10:30 when we entered the park. We saw couples on the benches in the back of the pool, and they all stared at us. And I guess they must have saw the gang there. I don't think they were 50 or 60 feet away. When we reached the front of the stairs, we looked up, and there was two of the gang members on top of the stairs. There were two smaller ones, and they had garrison belts wrapped around their hands. They didn't say nothing to us. They looked kind of scared.
I was scared. I knew they were going to jump them and everything, and I was scared. When they were coming up, they all separated and everything like that.
I saw the main body of the gang slowly walk out of the bushes on my right. I turned around fast to see what Michael was going to do, and this kid came running at me with a belt. Then I ran myself and told Michael to run.
He couldn't run anyway because we were all around him. He couldn't run. So I said, you're just there. He said, yeah, but I punched him in the face. And then somebody hit him with a bat over the head. And then I kept punching him. Some of them were too scared to do anything. They were just standing there looking.
I was watching him staring. I didn't want to hit him at first. Then I kicked him twice. He was laying on the ground looking up at us. I kicked him on the jaw or something. And then I kicked him in the stomach. That was the least I could do, was kick him.
I was aiming to hit him, but I didn't get a chance to hit him. There were so many guys on him. I got scared when I saw the knife go into the guy, and I ran right there. After everybody ran, this guy stayed and started hitting him with a machete.
The rest of the gang pursued Roger McShane.
I ran down the hill, and there was three more of the gang members down the bottom of the hill in the baseball field. And the kids chasing me down the hill yelled to them to get me.
Members of the gang remember.
Somebody yelled out, grab him, he's a jester. So then they grabbed him. The machine grabbed him, he turned around and stabbed him in the back. I was stunned. I couldn't do nothing. And then magician, he went like that, and he had a switchblade, and he said, you're going to hit him with the bat, I'll stab you. So I just hit him slightly across the knee, and I ran.
Magician stabbed him, and the guy, he like hunched over. He's standing up. And I came down, I knocked him down. Then he was down on the ground. Everybody was kicking, stomping, punching, stabbing. So he tried to get back up, and I knocked him down again. Then the guy stabbed him in the back with the bread knife.
I just went like that. I just stand with the bread knife. You know, I was drunk, so I just, you know, stabbed him. All I heard was the guy screaming. He screamed like a dog. He was screaming there. And I took the knife out and I told the guys to run. So I ran, and then the rest of the guys ran with me. They wanted to stay there and keep on doing this. I said, no, come on, don't kill that guy. And we ran.
The guy stabbed him in the back with the bread knife. He told me that when he took the knife out of his back, he said, thank you.
They got up fast right after they stabbed me, and I just laid there in my stomach. And it was five of them as they walked away. And as they walked away, this other big kid came down with a machete or some large knife of some sort. And he wanted to stab me too with it. And they told him, no, come on, we got him. We messed him up already, come on. And they took him up the hill, and they all walked up the hill. And right after that, all of them turned their heads and looked back at me. I got up and staggered into the street to get a cab. And I got in the taxi, and I asked them to take me to the medical center and get my friend, and I blacked out.
The gang scattered and fled from the park. This boy believes he is the last gang member who saw Michael Farmer this night.
Well, I was running up to the path. I saw somebody staggering up to the bushes, and I just looked and turned around and looked up and kept on running. I think that was the farmer boy. He was staggering in the bushes.
He left behind a boy nearly dead, continued home, had a glass of milk, went to bed. But then...
I couldn't sleep that night or nothing, because I always used to fall asleep for about half an hour and wake up again during the middle of the night. My mother said, what was the matter with you? It looked like something wrong. I said, nothing.
That boy used a baseball bat in the attack. This boy used a bread knife.
First I went to the river, you know, to throw my knife away, and then I went home. You know, I couldn't sleep. I was in bed. My mother kept on telling me, where was that? And I told her, you know, that I was in the movies. I was worried about them two boys. If they would have died, I knew I was going to get caught.
At Presbyterian Medical Center, Roger McShane was on the critical list. Before undergoing major surgery that saved his life, he told about the attack in Highbridge Park. The official police record reveals what happened next. The speaker, New York City's Deputy Police Commissioner Walter Arm.
A member of the hospital staff notified the police, and patrolmen of the 34th Precinct arrived at the hospital a few minutes afterward and learned from the McShane boy that his friend Michael Farmer was still in the park under attack. The patrolmen rushed to the park, where they found the farmer boy just before 11 p.m. He was lying on the ground off the footpath and moaning in pain. The policeman was soon joined by detectives, and young Farmer told them, the Egyptian kings got me. The farmer boy made this comment as he was being rushed to the hospital at 11.05 p.m. The parents of the boy were notified.
Mr. and Mrs. Farmer continue the story.
The sergeant from the 34th Precinct called us and asked who I was, and was I the father of Michael Farmer. I said I was, and he said, well, your boy is in Mother Cabrini Hospital in serious condition. I had identified myself further as a fireman in this area, and he says, oh, I'll come right down and give you a lift down to the hospital. So this sergeant drove us down to the hospital. As we walked in, the officer who was on duty there called the sergeant, and he said the boy had died 15 minutes earlier.
And the sister there in the hospital took us downstairs to identify his body. He had an expression as though he was just calling for help.
Well, it was real bad. He was my number one boy.
This boy had never been in trouble with the police. Several Egyptian kings and dragons claimed they often saw him with the jesters, assumed he was a member. The jesters say neither Farmer nor McShane belonged to their gang, and according to police, there is no evidence to the contrary. From the jesters, police learned which boys might have been involved in the assault at Highbridge Park. At 6:30 a.m., this gang member heard somebody knocking at the door of his apartment in a housing project.
I heard this knocking on the door. I didn't think it was the police, you know, because I thought I wasn't going to get caught. So I was laying in bed, and I told my mother, Mommy, I think that's the milkman knocking on the door, or somebody. She says, why aren't you wearing this? I says, no, I'm in my underwear. So she says, okay, I'll go. She opened the door. My mother comes over. You got in trouble last night? And I said, no, Mommy, I haven't gotten in no trouble last night. And so she says, because there's a policeman over here wants to see you. And I said, what for? And he says, something that happened last night. And I says, okay. Then I started thinking of trying to, you know, run away from the house. So I put on my clothes and I act innocent, you know. He says to me, you know what happened last night? I said, no, I don't know a thing that happened last night. I was in the car from 10 o'clock on. He says, what you doing in the car? And I said, just driving around, you know, talking about old things. He says, oh, well, if that's the truth, you don't have nothing to worry about. You like to come down to the police station with us? And I said, Okay.
Another gang member spent the morning in children's court pleading innocent to a robbery committed 2 weeks earlier. He was released pending a hearing. When he returned home, police were waiting to question him about the murder of Michael Farmer. This is the boy who used a bread knife in the assault at Highbridge Park.
When we was going to, you know, to the paddy wagon, and then the detective, he kept on wiping his feet on my suit. So then I told him to cut it out, and he still won't cut it out. So then the sergeant, he says, cut it out. So then he said, oh, why don't you mind your business? And he kept on doing it. He kept on wiping his feet on my suit. And I just got the suit out of the clinics. I told him that I just got the suit out of the clinic, And he says to me, that's just too bad. That suit belongs in the garbage can. So he kept on wiping his feet on my suit. They kept on saying, you murder and all this. They kept on saying, you're going to get the electric chair. You're going to get the electric chair. You murder. You're going to get the electric chair. They kept on saying that to me. I felt mad. If I had a gun right there, I would have shot them all.
He told us, I hate cops. The police say his story of what happened in that paddy wagon is fantasy. They also deny threatening another gang member who explains why he wanted to be caught.
I was cracking up. I said, why don't they hurry up and come and get me and get it over with? So when I got picked up, I felt safe then. We went in the car, and then they threatened me. I mean, not exactly a threat, but they told me what was going to happen. I'd get beat up if I didn't talk. So I told them, tell me who's the guy that squealed, you know. Told me, who you think you are, Dillinger or something? You know, get even with the guy? I said, no, I just wanted to know. He said, no. So he took me to the precinct. It made me laugh to see all the guys sitting there. When I walked in, everybody said, ha, ha, ha. You know, start laughing. So I felt all right with the fellas, you know. See, my girl was sitting there anyway. You see, she had the knives.
Police found two hunting knives hidden in the bureau drawer of a 15-year-old girlfriend of the gang. Two gang members admitted that they gave these knives to the girl after the assault at Highbridge Park. The police record continues.
A search of the gang during their interrogation yielded five knives, several garrison belts, and a heavy length of chain. All of the young men arrested made full admissions to the police officers and to representatives from the staff of District Attorney Hogan. At 8 p.m. the following day, seven of the boys were charged with homicide. Two others were charged with attempted homicide, and 10 more were charged with juvenile delinquency.
Police said this is the largest group of boys ever arrested for a New York City killing. Statistically, they were among 58 youths in the city arrested in 1957 for murder and non-negligent manslaughter. Among more than 3,000 youths under 21 arrested in the nation last year for crimes of major violence. And among an estimated 1 million youths arrested for crimes of all kinds. The father of Michael Farmer attended the preliminary court hearing of the gang members, later indicted for the murder of his son. As he watched them arraigned before a judge, he made a judgment of his own.
They are monsters. In my mind, I classify them as savage animals, and that's all. I don't think that they have any civilization in them. They haven't any concept of living with other people outside of to show that they can do something worse than the other or to claim any sort of notoriety. These boys didn't even hang their heads, most of them, when they came into court. They stood erect and looked around the court for their relatives and so forth. One of them had a small smirk when he looked in that direction. They should be put away and kept away. Or, if the penalty is death, to be executed. Certainly, they set themselves up in the form of a judge and jury and execution squad in the case of my son. All a matter of minutes. This is pure jungle activity.
Two detectives told the judge at the gang's arraignment, these boys showed no remorse and gave us little cooperation. At their murder trial, some of the boys testified that police beat and frightened them into making confessions. The police officers accused denied this under oath. First reports on this crime suggested that at least one gang member had stabbed for thrills. Police said the 14-year-old boy who used a bread knife in the attack told them, I always wanted to know what it would feel like to stick a knife through human bone. The same boy denied to us that he said that, gave us three other reasons for his crime. First,
I told you, I didn't know what I was doing. I was drunk. I don't know, you know, I was drunk. I didn't know what I was doing. I just went like that and I stabbed him.
We asked him, did you know the boy you stabbed? Answer, no, but I thought he was a jester. Question, had the jesters ever done anything to you? Answer,
they kept on calling me a spick. They kept on saying, you dirty spick, get out of this block.
Every time I go in the pool, they say to me the same thing. I don't bother them because, you know, I didn't want to get in a trouble with them. But one day they beat me up. You know, there was about five of them, and it was only me alone. They beat me up. I had to take a chance to get the guys so we could beat them up.
He said his third reason for stabbing a boy he did not know involved his fear of gang discipline.
See, because we said before, if anybody don't beat up somebody, when we get back, he's going to get beat up. So I said, okay. You know, they got special guys, you know, to keep their eyes on the boys. Whoever doesn't swing out is going to get it when we come back. You got to press through a line. They got about 15 boys over here and 15 boys over here, you know, straight line like that. You got to pass through there. They all got belts in their hands.
So far, we have heard that a boy was killed because other boys, most of them under 15, got drunk, wanted revenge, feared gang discipline. Only one boy charged with murder pleaded not guilty on grounds of insanity. He was declared legally sane. But a psychiatrist testified in court that this boy was epileptic and incapable of premeditating or deliberating. Court-appointed defense counsel did not request psychiatric examination of the other six boys on trial for their lives. The jury that convicted some of them heard very little about their mental and emotional makeup. Our reporter tried to get psychiatric reports on the other gang members too young to be tried for murder. He questioned Marion Cohen, head of the treatment service, New York City Youth House, and she told him,
"We see our function as holding boys remanded temporarily for children's court until disposition of their case is made by a judge. While the boy is here, we try to study and diagnose the boy's problems."
Well, now, the younger members of the gang that killed Michael Farmer were brought here. Did you study the individual boys, make reports on them for the judge who was going to try them?
No, we did not.
Why not?
Because the judge did not request it.
Is this usual practice?
No. In most cases, judges are interested in finding out as much as they can about the individual boy's problems in order to differentiate his needs.
But in this case, nothing was found out about the mental makeup or the individual needs of these boys. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, do you usually wait for the court to request such studies?
No. When we are fully staffed, we do a study on every boy who is here for more than a week.
Why didn't you study these boys then?
Because we are two-thirds understaffed. We have only four caseworkers for 300 boys.
The New York City Youth House is a brand-new $5 million building. It has a swimming pool, self-service elevators, the most modern equipment. But there are only four caseworkers for 300 boys. Reason? Low pay and a shortage of trained personnel. Our reporter continues his conversation with Marion Cohen.
Can you make any generalizations about the gang members you have studied?
Yes. These are kids who essentially feel in themselves weak and inadequate and have to present a tough facade to others. Of course, most adolescents feel insecure, but these boys have a distorted idea of what real adequacy is. They become easy prey for leaders whose sole drive is aggressive. They are egged on by their peers to establish a tough reputation, each kid daring the others to go one step further. They have to compete on a level of violence.
It would seem that members of the Egyptian Kings and Dragons gang fit the pattern. Consider the statement of this 14-year-old gang member who participated in the assault at Highbridge Park.
I didn't want to be, like, you know, different from the other guys. Like, they hit him, I hit him. In other words, I don't want to show myself as a punk. You know, you're always talking, oh, man, when I catch a guy, I'll beat him up and all that, you know. So after you talk like that and you catch a guy and you don't do nothing, you know, I said, oh, man, he can't belong to no gang because he ain't going to do nothing.
Are we to believe that a boy is dead, murdered, because those who killed him fear being called punks? Another gang member says he acted to protect his reputation. He calls it rep.
Momentarily, I started thinking about it inside. Then I have my mind made up. I'm not going to be in no gang. Then I go on outside, and something else come up. Then here come all my friends coming to me. Like I said before, I'm intelligent and so forth. And they be coming to me, and they talk about what they're going to do. Like, man, we're going out here to kill this cat. And I said, yeah. They kept on talking and talking. And I said, man, I just got to go with you. Myself, I don't want to go. But when they start talking about what they're going to do, I said, no, he's going to take over my rep. I ain't going to let him be no more than me. Then I'll go ahead just for selfishness.
That boy admits that he kicked and punched Roger McShane during the attack at Highbridge Park. Didn't stab him because he didn't have a knife. We asked, suppose you had a knife, would you have used it? Answer.
If I had got the knife, I would have stabbed him. That would have gave me more of a builder. People would respect me for what I've done and things like that. They said, there goes a cold killer.
He wants people to say, there goes a cold killer. He's only 14 years old, the same age as the boy who used a bread knife in the Highbridge Park attack, and who told us why he, too, wants to be known as a cold killer.
Makes you feel like a big shot. You know, some guys think they're big shots and all that. They think, you know, they got the power, you know, to do this, you know, to do everything they feel like doing. Let's say, like, I want to stab a guy, and then the other guy say, oh, I wouldn't dare to do that, you know. He thinks I'm acting like a big shot. That's the way he feels. And he probably thinks in his mind, oh, he probably wouldn't do that. And then when we're going to fight, you know, he finds out what I do.
Some gang members told police that they bragged to each other about beating and stabbing Farmer and McShane, wanted to make certain they would be known as tough guys. According to the official police record, this was the reaction of their parents.
During the hours that the boys were rounded up and brought to the Wandsworth Avenue station, many of their parents came to the scene. They expressed shock and bewilderment and disbelief over the fact that their boys were being questioned by police and might have had a part in this hideous crime. When they finally realized that this was true, they still couldn't believe it.
One mother told our reporter,
I had absolutely no problems with him. Anyone in the neighborhood can vouch for that. And when I walked out there this morning, all my storekeepers and everything just can't believe that my son is mixed up in anything like this. I have no idea what I can do for him right now. Doubt if there's anything that we can do for him right now.
Do you plan to go over and see him?
Of course, I have to go and see my job. I can't let him down now. Even though he was wrong, I still can't just turn my back on him.
Parents went to see their sons in jail. And how did they react when they saw them? One boy said,
my mother said she was ashamed of me and everything, and I told her that it wasn't my fault and I couldn't help it. My father wanted to kill me at first, and after I explained to him what happened, he was still like, felt bad about the shame to walk the streets and something like that. But then, you know, because he knew I was forced, but he wouldn't touch me then after I told him what happened.
The statement of another gang member.
Well, my father understood. He didn't actually understood, but, you know, he didn't take it as hard as my mother. My mother, she came out in the newspapers. She had a heart attack. It's a lucky thing she's alive today.
One mother talked to her son in the presence of the other boys arrested. Here is what she said, according to this gang member who was present.
When she seen him, she said to him, how did it feel when you did that to Farmer? It was good, huh? You know, joking around with the kid. So we told her, it says, you know what your son did? And she says, he stabbed him in the back. She says, she just went like that, shrugged her, you know, shoulders. And then we didn't pay attention to her because, you know, you don't like to see a mother acting like that with a kid, you know?
What is known about the mental and emotional makeup of parents whose children commit crimes? Dr. Marjorie Ritwagen, a staff psychiatrist for New York Children's Courts, gave us some statistics.
We find that some 75 to 80% of parents of children who are brought into this court are emotionally ill or have severe personality or character disorders. These include sociopathic personality disorders, alcoholics, and the like. And about 10% of this 75 to 80% are committively psychotic. In fact, some parents go completely berserk in court, threaten judges, and are sent to psychiatric wards for observation. Most of these parents are so overwhelmed with their own problems that they ignore their children. Kids feel not so much rejected as non-entities. And usually, in these homes, there are no fathers.
There are no fathers in the homes of five of the seven gang members tried for the murder of Michael Farmer. Four of these boys lived with their mothers, one with his grandparents. His mother told our reporter why she left her son.
He has lived with my mother all his life from birth. I lived here up to 2-3 years ago. It seems like since I left my child, everything just happened. Not that I just walked out on him. When I planned to get married, I spoke to him and everything. He says, well, go ahead. You have to have some happiness. You can't just stay with me all the time. So I said, will you be willing to come with me? No, I don't want to leave my grandparents.
Do you think that it would have been important if he had stayed with you?
I think it would have been important had I stayed with him and not leave him at the age of 15. I wouldn't advise it to anyone that has a boy child or any other child.
11 of the 18 boys arrested in the Farmer case came from homes broken by desertion, divorce, or death. Children's Court psychiatrist Marjorie Ritwagon says this is the pattern.
Some 70 to 80% of our children come from homes broken by desertion or divorce. Most of the children stay with their mothers. At critical times in their lives, they are left in a fatherless home. They're almost afraid to relate too closely to their mothers and are often driven into the streets to seek companionship with a gang. They find this superficial group relationship more comfortable than individual ones. In fact, difficulty in relating to people is one of their big handicaps. They don't talk out their problems, they act them out.
Example, this 13-year-old boy. He lives with a mother, married and divorced three times. She works to support him, cannot spend much time with him. Her son has plenty of problems, but she doesn't know about them.
I never tell her about my problems. One reason is if I tell her my problems, like some guys are beating me up, she keep me in the house and, don't let me go out. Or if I tell her I'm doing bad in school, she probably hit me. Or if I tell her I had an argument with a teacher or something like that, she probably hit me. She don't give me a chance to explain, you know. She just comes out in power. She hits me. I don't tell her anything.
He doesn't talk out his problems. He acts them out, sometimes by firing a BB gun at adults.
I'll tell you the truth, sometimes I used to shoot people myself. Or sometimes I would shoot the people I don't like too much, you know. I would be up the roof, and they would be walking by with packages or something, and pow, I would shoot them.
Violence is all around him, he says.
Well, usually I go for horror pictures like Frankenstein and the Mummy or things like that. But I like when he goes and kills the guy and or rips a guy in half or something like that. or when he throws somebody off a cliff. You know, all them exciting things.
Next, the gang member who used a bread knife in the Highbridge Park attack. He lived with his mother and stepfather. Told us he often quarreled with his mother. Wanted his stepfather to spend more time with him.
I'll ask him to take me boat riding, me fishing. Some places like that, ball game. I said, no, he don't go no place. The only place about he goes to the bar, and from the bar he goes home, sleep. That's about all he do. I don't talk with my parents a lot of times. I don't hardly talk to them. There's nothing to talk about. There's nothing to discuss about. They can't help me.
They can't help me. What he wants, he says, is to be like his favorite comic book hero.
Mighty Mouse. He's a mouse, you know, but he's dressed, you know, like Superman. And he got little pants, the red, the shirt is yellow. You know, and then he helps out the mouse. Every time the cat's trying to get the mouse, Mighty Mouse come and help the mouse. He's just like Superman. Nothing can hurt him.
Another boy told us, my father doesn't want to hear my troubles. They make him mad. Reason?
He wants me to be better than my other brothers, you see. That's why every time he comes to me and say, you see, you're going to be like your brother, the one that's in the tombs. If you keep on doing wrong, you're going to be like him. He kept on telling me that, so I said, well, if he wants me to be like him, I'm going to be like him. So I started doing wrong things. And he says to me, I don't want to catch you in trouble. Well, in one way, he should have got me in trouble before because he found a gun that I had. You know, I had a homemade, and he found it. He didn't say nothing. He just broke it up and threw it away and kept me in the house for one day. He should have took it to the police or something, you know, told them that I had it. And maybe I would have got sent to the youth house someplace, you know, before, and I wouldn't have gotten so much trouble, then I would have learned my lesson.
This was his first arrest, but 10 of the 18 boys involved in the Farmer case had previous records as juvenile offenders, some for such minor offenses as trespassing or chalking names on buildings, others for serious crimes, including assault, burglary, and attempted grand larceny. Three gang members were under the supervision of probation officers. But how much supervision does a boy on probation get in New York City? Clarence Leeds is chief probation officer at Children's Court.
Our probation officers have minimum caseloads of between 60 and 70 delinquent boys apiece. This means that at best they can talk to each boy perhaps once a month. And you can't give a child the guidance and help he needs by seeing him that infrequently. We are doing just about double the number of caseloads and investigations that we are equipped to handle. And possibly as a consequence of this, about 30% of the boys on probation commit new offenses which will bring them to the attention of the court once again.
Three Egyptian dragons on probation participated in the murder of Michael Farmer. Another member of this gang had served 1 year in a state training school for juvenile delinquents. was diagnosed as a dangerous psychopath, but received no psychotherapy. Reason? There are 500 boys in this institution. Only one psychiatrist and one psychologist to treat them. 5 months after this dangerous psychopath was released from the institution, he stabbed Roger McShane at Highbridge Park. Who's to blame? John Warren Hill, Chief Justice of New York's Children's Court, told us why very many disturbed children are released quickly by state institutions.
It is a shocking fact that children committed to state institutions by this court often are discharged from these institutions within 4 to 6 months without having received any real treatment or help. Why? Because our state facilities for the long-term care of delinquent children are so shockingly inadequate that our state institutions must make these discharges quickly in order to make room for new court commitments. For while the rate of delinquency has increased in New York City since 1951 through 1956 by 83%, as revealed by our own court statistics, there has not been one single additional bed provided in our state institutions for delinquent children, aside from some few which the city made available for use by the state. But that was a bare nothing compared to the great need which has developed increasingly in this area.
Children released from New York institutions are put on parole. The Egyptian dragon, diagnosed as a dangerous psychopath, was assigned to a youth parole worker, was under the supervision of this worker at the time of the Farmer murder. But how closely was he watched? Joseph Linda is in charge of youth parole workers, New York City area.
Each of our youth parole workers supervises about 80 boys, and in some cases about 100 boys because of staff shortage. This means that they may see these boys as infrequently as once every 2 months.
Youth parole and probation agencies are non-existent in half the counties of this nation. In most of the other counties, they are understaffed, according to a survey by the National Probation and Parole Association. Some responsibility for supervising problem children often is shifted to the schools by the courts. This happened in the case of several Egyptian kings and dragons brought to court prior to the murder of Michael Farmer. The speaker, Murray Sachs, court liaison officer, Board of Education, New York City.
The courts have made a number of requests in the helping of these youngsters. The unfortunate thing about these children was this. They would refuse to come to school. Not coming to school, they wouldn't be doing the things that we think are constructive and helpful. It seemed that the only one that might help them would be the institution where they might be placed and given individualized and controlled assistance of one kind or another. Again, we're faced with the serious problem. They have just no place for them.
In the richest state in the nation, long-term institutional care is not available for 80% of delinquent children under 12 years of age. No state institution for these children exists. The few private institutions are jammed. One gang member involved in the Farmer case committed 5 offenses before he was 12 years old. Within a week or two after each arrest, he was set free in the community. At 12, children are eligible for state training schools, but even then it is difficult to place them because of overcrowding. John Warren Hill, Chief Justice of New York Children's Court, sums up the result.
In a great number of cases of very disturbed children, children who should be removed from the community, this court has been unable to find any placement for the child, and our only alternative has been to place these children on probation, which of course means their return to the community.
So they're sent back to the streets, unhelped, unsupervised, set free in the community. What do they do with their time? Listen to one boy describe a typical summer day in his neighborhood of brick tenements in Manhattan's Upper West Side.
I usually get up at 11 or 12 o'clock, you know. I sleep late. And then I will go out, see the guys that would be sitting on the stoop, you know, doing nothing. Our block is crowded. And we didn't hardly have a chance to play because the buses keep going back and forth, back and forth. We couldn't do nothing. So we just sit. And then when it got to nighttime, you know, and we would go around and say, come on, man, let's go break windows, you know, for some excitement, or come on, man, let's go popping, you know. Then we would go and look for guys, beat them up, come back. And then we just start talking and talking.
Consider the day of another boy, 16 years old. He makes the rounds of schools, pool halls, and candy store hangouts. He works for a syndicate, sells marijuana cigarettes to other children, and smokes them himself.
I get the dough by selling it. I take about 4 or 5 a day. It keeps me going. It all depends when I get up in the morning. Take 1, 2, 3 hours later, take another one. If I ain't got nothing to do, I just feel like goofing or cracking up or laughing. Anybody, just take another one. go to a dance, take two or three. If you don't get it, you usually try all kinds of, not violence, but you see an easy dollar to rob it, you rob it. You see something to pawn, you pawn it.
Boys troubled and adrift in the community formed the gang that killed Michael Farmer. Sociologists call gangs of this breed antisocial groups or fighting gangs. They exist in most of our large cities. According to police estimates, there are 134 of these gangs in Los Angeles County, 24 in Miami, 110 in New York, including the Egyptian Kings and Dragons. We shall attempt now to report some of the history of this gang up to the time of the killing at Highbridge Park. In the course of the story, you will hear gang terms that require definition. This gang member defines them for our reporter.
What is the piece?
A piece is a gun.
How about to burn?
To burn means to shoot a guy with a gun.
What do you mean by bop?
Bop, it means a gang war.
What is a coolie?
A coolie is a guy that ain't in gangs. He ain't in nothing, you know? He's just conservative.
What is turf?
Turf, that means a territory. Each gang has its territory.
The territory of the Egyptian Kings and Dragons is a neighborhood in transition. Crowded tenements and some modest apartment houses are giving way to giant housing projects. The population is constantly shifting. A spokesman for City Youth Board says, whenever you have great population, mobility, and disruption, gangs spring up to replace the broken stability of the group. Criminologist Louis Yablonsky of Columbia University directed a crime prevention program in this area at the time the Egyptian Kings and Dragons gang was organized.
This gang began forming about 2 years ago in a 20-block area of Manhattan's Upper West Side. The pattern was typical of antisocial gangs in large cities. It was organized by a handful of emotionally disturbed leaders, boys who have a long record of gang activity. First, they organized the so-called Villains and Scorpions, merged these two gangs into the GGIs, meaning Greater Gangs Incorporated. That broke up. Then these same leaders started a gang known as the Dragons, which joined forces with the Egyptian Kings to form the overall gang that killed Michael Farmer.
Dr. Yablonsky studied this gang for 2 years and closely observed its leaders.
These leaders are boys in their late teens and early 20s. They have strong needs to push people around, primarily because of their own feelings of insecurity. They are Hitler types who have delusions of being persecuted. For example, when you talk to these boys, they say, everybody is against me, or they're all out to get us. They feel they have no future, no ability to be successful except in gang activities. In the fantasy of the gang world, they picture themselves as supreme commanders, dominating an army of boys and controlling vast areas of territory.
One Egyptian Kings and Dragons leader told us, we organize for protection. The other gangs start the trouble. According to him, this is how the trouble begins.
You have a certain piece of land, and so another club want to take over your land, you know, to have more space and so forth. They'll fight you for it. If you win, you got your land. If you don't win, they got your land. Then the person at law is going to get up another group to help them out and start all over again, fight for the land again.
The ancient tragedy of nations repeated on city streets. Their leaders assume familiar titles.
First, there's the president. He got the whole gang. Then there comes the vice president. He's second in command. Then there's the war council or warlord, whichever you want to call it. That's the one that starts the fights. And then there's the prime minister. You know, he goes along with the war council to see when they're going to fight, where they're going to fight. And after that, just club members.
Membership in this gang was fluid. Some boys joined 1 week and quit the next. Several boys arrested in the Farmer case had been members for only a few months. They did not participate in some of the gang's activities about to be mentioned in this report. Not all of the gang members joined because they wanted to fight. They gave us other reasons.
All them guys, you know, they used to go around to parties. I figured it must be a new experience, you know, so I joined to see how it was.
Why I joined the gang? Most of my friends were in there, you know, guys I hanged around with. So they told me if I didn't belong to the gang, not to come around the block so much, you know.
Most of the fellas join our gang because, when you know, they have trouble at home, the rest of the guys would take care of them, give them money, help them out when they run away from home, give them something to eat, help them out until they get a job, you know.
Some boys were forced to join the gang. Reason?
We made them join the club because we thought they could fight. So we made them join the club. And after they got in, they seen the club was all right, you know, not so much trouble, so they stayed in.
At the start of this report, you heard one gang member say he was forced to attack Michael Farmer and Roger McShane at Highbridge Park. Here is the same boy explaining why he joined the gang in the first place.
I didn't want to be in the gang, but they forced me because they said if you don't join, we're going to beat you up. How do I know? They might have something in their pockets, switchblades or a gun maybe.
According to Murray Sachs, Board of Education court liaison officer, the gang intimidated many boys in the neighborhood.
These youngsters were threatened on the way to school or were held up or were approached and asked to become members of the Egyptian kings. Very often they were told that if they weren't going to bring money, they would be beaten up. It wasn't until sometimes these youngsters got so involved by having to bring an average of a dollar a week as part of the extortion arrangement, and under pressure they couldn't produce it, that they would stay out of school. And there's where we first get the reports by this absence. And when you try to get the youngster who was assaulted or threatened to talk, they'd fear talking. Parents themselves sometimes fear to even make a charge where an assault and extortion was actually carried out. And so we were left in a position where we could do very little.
Instead of action, paralysis and fear. Some parents forbade their children to play on the streets in the evening. A mother who requested anonymity told us,
I was very frightened. In fact, I had to stay at the window every evening while they were playing ball because these boys were coming up in gangs and they had gas and belts and they had knives. And three times I called the police station. And there were also girls coming up too. They had Pepsi Cola bottles in their skirts. And my 14-year-old girl would come up crying. It was pretty bad.
A father who would not record a statement or permit us to use his name says members of this gang beat him up in the street when he tried to stop them from molesting his son. Murray Sachs reports on what happened to some school teachers.
We had the unfortunate experience of some of these youngsters coming into the school and threatening teachers. In one instance, they thought that their friend was going to be punished. Anyhow, they walked in and they simply hauled off and let the teacher have it.
The gang liked one school recreation center. This was the reason.
Once we was in the school, we'd all go down to the lunchroom where they were playing records and cards. We'd get in a group, you know, a big circle, have our meetings. The teachers never bothered us because we never made any noise. Just kept it low.
What could have been done to check this gang? The New York City Youth Board assigns street workers to some gangs, especially violent ones. The worker remains with the gang on the streets and in its hangouts. According to the Youth Board, no gang assigned a street worker has rumbled or been involved in a killing. 2 years before the farmer killing, several members of the Egyptian Kings asked their youth parole officer, Lloyd Johnson, to get them a street worker.
I had about 10 boys who were in the Egyptian Kings under my parole supervision. They came to me and said, well, look, we'd like to have a detached worker, someone who can spend a lot more time with us. And I explained that I would go ahead and contact the youth board and see what could be done.
He found out what could be done in one word: nothing. Ralph Whalen, executive director of the New York City Youth Board, explains the reason.
We must remember that the City Youth Board is an experimental and a demonstration project, particularly its street club project, and we have been only active in 5 areas of New York City. Unfortunately, we have not had the funds to expand our program beyond these areas. Had we the monies available, we would certainly have covered every fighting gang that has come to our attention, and that includes the Egyptian Kings.
No funds, no street worker. That was the answer parole officer Johnson took back to the gang.
I'll never forget it. One of the boys said to me, half in jest and still disappointed, I guess we'll have to go off and kill someone before they ever give us a worker. As it turned out, one of the boys that I was working with was involved in the Michael Farmer killing.
Before the killing, the New York City Youth Board got a warning from a community crime prevention committee headed by Dr. Louis Yablonsky.
2 months before the Farmer killing, we warned the New York City Youth Board at a meeting that unless something drastic was done about this gang, a possible killing could be expected. Our recommendation was that a so-called detached gang worker be assigned to the group. But the Youth Board indicated they could not free a worker from another gang to work with this gang.
Dr. Yablonsky and a community organization of adult volunteers tried to reach the gang.
We talked to them in their hangouts and tried to get them interested in constructive activities, but it was impossible to make any progress with the leaders. They were too emotionally disturbed to work with in the open community, but we were able to work with other gang members who accepted help.
Dr. Yablonsky tape recorded some of his conversations with these boys. The conversation you're about to hear is ominous in view of what was to happen later. This gang member feared he would commit a murder.
As I say, I have to be gone pretty soon before I'm going to get in bad trouble.
Well, you think you're going to shoot somebody?
shoot him, stab him, or strangle him. What's going to happen to me after? So if I go now, I won't have to go long, like if I strangle somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Then I get sent.
You figure now you can do a year.
Year, two, I don't care. Huh? So you want me to see that psychiatrist or whatever he is?
I'd like you to.
Make an appointment for me Monday.
All right.
That boy did not participate in the murder of Michael Farmer. He got help and quit the gang. Two men in the community, one a chef, the other an import-export executive, became big brothers to 10 other gang members, helped these boys with their problems, took them on excursions to places of interest, eventually persuaded them to leave the gang. They did this in their spare time. When they tried to recruit other volunteers to work with the gang, this is what happened.
As a matter of fact, we couldn't get one single person to work with these kids on a volunteer basis. The reason given was that they were actually afraid of these kids. They thought that they should be sent away through the courts or taken out of the community. The other reason that we have gathered from our investigations is that people would much rather worry about their own problems than take part in community activities.
People were afraid or concerned with their own problems. The gang was not their problem, they said. Let the courts handle it, or the police, or the schools, or the social agencies. By the summer of 1957, the gang was feuding with the Jesters, predominantly an Irish gang in Michael Farmer's neighborhood. According to a Jester, the Egyptian Kings and Dragons started the trouble.
We're mostly a defensive fighting team, you know, but they're offensive. They come up here and we're raiding parties and we'll fight, you know, but if they don't come up, we won't fight. There's never been a time when we've invaded them when they haven't come up here first.
They came up to use the swimming pool at Highbridge Park. The Egyptian Kings and Dragons claimed the Jesters tried to keep them out, said, "This is our territory." Some parents in the neighborhood wanted the pool closed. The mother of Roger McShane told us why.
There have been petitions signed and signed and signed, and the mothers has complained of their children that growing up here can't use the pool. Why should they have this crowds coming up in the subway to use it when the children up here cannot use it? The children have to sneak in after hours to get a swim, like Roger and Michael and a few of the other boys that's all around. Because they couldn't go in unless they wanted to be in gangs and fight and use knives and guns like them and stand up to them. But any boy that didn't want to do that could not go in that pool through the day. Why was it allowed to go on so long till a boy was sacrificed over in the park?
According to a member of the Egyptian Kings and Dragons, here is what the Jesters did at the pool 2 weeks before the assault on Farmer and Roger McShane.
They came behind the pool, and one guy, the president, he's a Negro, he said, "I'm going to burn you," you know, so he pulled out a gun. It looked like a .45 and pointed it at us. Everybody said, "Run to the water," you know. So I ran, and I dived into the water. They were waiting outside, you know, around the pool. We seen them. So we told some little kids that we know to go down and get some of the fur so we get out of the pool. So they went down, and three of them came to the pool, you know, in front of the gate, and told us it was all right to come out now because we had the fellas around.
Here is the Jester's version of the same incident.
There was about 50 of them in the pool, and a few of us walked behind there, and we looked in, we seen them, and they started hollering things out, like, you know, names, and you're going to be wasted and all this. So we told them they weren't going home then. And then we went back around the block, and we thought that they were going to come around the block for a fight. And this boy was walking in the park, and he isn't on the team or anything like that. He was just walking through the park, looking in the pool, and about 35 guys from the Kings come out, and they smacked him on the head with a bat, and he got 8 stitches, I think.
2 weeks later, Michael Farmer was killed. Before his murder, a mother in the neighborhood wrote a letter to city officials requesting a police crackdown on the Egyptian Kings and Dragons, but she did not mail the letter. In telling us her reason, she requested anonymity, said she feared gang retaliation.
I didn't send the letter because some of the mothers whom I was asking to sign were saying to me that their son said that this here business had ended, that there was a truce negotiated between the Egyptian Kings and the Jesters, and there wouldn't be any more trouble. And a lot of the mothers felt that if we were to send this petition regardless, perhaps it would start these flare-ups all over again. And many pointed out to me very specifically that if I were the one that were to send them, perhaps my children would be hurt because of it. And well, it made me a little worried. To my regret, I waited and Michael Farmer was killed.
No truce existed. And on the night of July 30, 1957, the Egyptian Kings and Dragons went to Highbridge Park. The news of Michael Farmer's murder shocked the city, and now it acted. the youth board got an emergency appropriation of funds, assigned street workers to the jesters and to the Egyptian kings and dragons who remained in the community. The police department assigned more patrolmen to the Highbridge Park area. The community mental health board sent a so-called disaster team to the area to survey the causes of juvenile crime. It released a report 2 weeks after the death of Michael Farmer. Here's the essence of it.
Residents traced the origin of juvenile crime to parents' inability to control their children, racial issues, newcomers in the area, lack of police protection, intimidation of teachers and policemen by youth gangs, and a lack of restrictive measures in Highbridge Park. Persons interviewed reported 16 major incidents leading to death or hospitalization in the last 3 years, 10 of them in the last 2 weeks. Most of the incidents had not been reported to police for fear of gang retaliation. Among the population in general, there were attitudes of hopelessness, helplessness, and fear. A large number of people expect gang retaliation after the present crisis has quieted down. They are cynical and see no way of preventing retaliation, for it has always occurred in the past. About 40% of children between the ages of 3 and 16 reacted immediately with a variety of physical and emotional symptoms. For the first time, some children began to carry knives for their own protection.
One boy in the neighborhood who fears for his life is Michael Farmer's friend Roger McShane, a state's witness at the murder trial of the Egyptian kings and dragons. During the trial, McShane received 2 death threats in the mail. One letter said, "You're alive, but if them guys get the chair, we'll kill you." That threat possibly came from a crank, but no one can be sure, least of all Roger McShane.
There's nothing you can do except protect yourself, and it's just going to get wilder and wilder. I mean, it's just going to get worse. You can't have a policeman walking around with every boy or girl that leaves his house at night and follow him to the store if he has to go to the store, or follow him up to the show. You can't have a policeman follow each individual all around the neighborhood just so they can be protected.
The parents of Michael Farmer.
Very much afraid for my son, Ramey. Ramey's 14. Who knows that the rest of these Egyptian kings won't come up looking for him or try to extend their activities, make themselves a little bit more infamous. You can't reason with the type of minds that they have. You don't know what they'll come up with next.
I'm worried about all of us. There was a time when I'd run down at night for milk or to mail a letter, and now I wouldn't go down the street after 9 o'clock. I just have that terrible feeling that something is lurking there in the dark.
Fear remains in this community. A new summer approaches, and according to one volunteer youth worker in the area, already there are danger signals.
The situation is beginning to look critical once again. We find that one of the Egyptian kings, apparently not involved in the Michael Farmer killing, is now trying to reorganize a gang and is recruiting in the area. Unless something is done very quickly with this particular gang, we are definitely going to run into the same situation in a very short time. You can't say whether that will be 6 months or a year from now, but if this gang is allowed to reorganize again, there may be more killings, and something had better be done fast if we are interested in saving other children from the fate of Michael Farmer.
What has been solved by the verdict of a jury and the commitment of 15 boys to institutions which are ill-equipped to rehabilitate them, and because of overcrowding may soon return them to the community? The problem of juvenile crime continues. The experts may list all sorts of causes, but they agree on one answer to why these conditions continue to exist. We permit them to. This is Ed Murrow. Good night.
CBS Radio has presented Who Killed Michael Farmer? A documented report on the murder of a teenage boy. Narrated by Edward R. Murrow. Produced and written by J. McMullen. Associated in production, Arthur Raymond. This was a Unit 1 presentation of CBS News.